Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Next Big Thing podcast. Now, today on the podcast, we have a very special guest. We've never had anyone who has been on Shark Tank before, at least not to my knowledge. And I'm so excited to have Maddie. She is one of the co-founders of Aura Bora. She started the company with her husband, and I wanted to have her on specifically for a couple of reasons. As my listeners know, we focus on female founders, and there's a reason why I don't mention that the podcast is all about female founders in the description, and that is because we need to start to normalize the fact that female founders exist, and we need to stop calling them female founders and just call them founders. But the challenging part of this is that there still are some difficulties, I mean, a lot of difficulties with being a female founder. In fact, if you look at the stats from 2020 and the start of the pandemic, you'll see that female founders and founders of color, especially women of color, received so much less funding than if they had a man as part of the co-founding duo, or it was two men. So we still have a lot of we have a way to go when it comes to supporting female founders and even female founders that are part of a female-male co-founding duo like Maddie is. So Maddie did start Aura Bora with her husband, but I wanted to talk to her specifically not only about their journey on Shark Tank, which is so fun to talk about. I'm so excited for you guys to listen to this, but also just what it's been like being a female founder and what it's been like going to events. And also we talk about so many other really cool things. They are disrupting the sparkling water industry space. And their sparkling water, Aura Bora, is delicious, you guys. You need to go pick up a can, especially if you're in the States. It is so good. If you love sparkling water, you are missing out. You have to go grab it. Maddie talks about where you can find Aura Bora at the end of the episode. So make sure to stick through all the way to the end so you can hear where you can go pick some up for yourself. But the whole story is fascinating. I'm also really impressed by the fact that they launched this brand so quickly and they were able to carry it on throughout the pandemic. And now they're raising their Series A funding, which is phenomenal. The brand is going places and it is so cool to talk to Maddie and hear all about her journey. So I hope you guys love this episode. We actually start this episode talking about Expo West, which is a trade show that happens. And so we started off talking about that, and then we talk about it a little bit later too. So if you're in the CPG industry or you have some kind of product, like physical product, I think you'll love hearing this episode. And I will catch you guys on the flip side. And so you're among, I'd imagine, I mean, it's a lot of CPG brands. You're among a lot of probably competitors, right? So for you guys, when you're going to these conferences, because we talk about like trade shows and conferences too, but since I started this podcast in 2020, it's like a little bit different now because people are starting to come out of the woodwork and start to actually go to those things. What was it like being in an in-person event like that when you're surrounded by so many different brands, so many different people?
Gosh, it was completely crazy. I was not prepared for how absolutely massive Expo West would feel. And then on top of that, Paul has been doing an immense amount of networking. I should specify, Paul's my husband. Yeah. Yes, Paul's my husband. Okay. And the co-founder of Aura Bora. And he has been way more boots on the ground the last few years, getting to know other founders and investors and retailers. And so we got there and I didn't stop talking from 7:30 a.m. when we met up with our team till sometimes 10 or 11 p.m. after a few mixers and after parties. And as an introvert, I was like, holy cow, I've not been around this many people in years.
I'm an introvert too. And I think about that and I'm like, that is daunting.
It was, I seriously slept like 11, 12 hours for the whole week following. There were a lot of things that were really exciting. Like, we're posted up next to some brands we adore. Our booth was across from Honey Mama's amazing team. We're next to Bonza, who all day is handing out free macaroni
Bonza's
samples.
Huge. Yeah.
We were, yes, blessed by, it's basically adult trick-or-treating is what we were saying. People walk around with these gigantic tote bags and just fill them with snacks and drinks.
Did I lose them?
So it was really sweet.
That sounds like so much fun. And when you guys were thinking about going to Expo West, what goals did you have in mind?
So a big one was connecting with retailers. That was our biggest, was making sure we got FaceTime with some big retailers like Whole Foods expanding into other regions, and a number of other natural grocer retailers are just strolling around. And so we were really hoping to connect with them, and we did. Every retailer we were hoping to connect with, we had a chance to talk to. So that was huge.
It's amazing.
And then the next tier down was just exposure. We handed out thousands of samples to people who are really into brands and really into natural food and bev. So that's another big win.
That's awesome. And so I want to go back to the inklings and beginnings of Ora Bora, because like when you started the brand with your husband, were you already husband and wife, and then you decided to start the brand?
Okay, so it was 2019. Paul and I had been married for a little over 2 years. We were living in Denver, and we had had a very short career. We were very young. Paul and I, the first year of our marriage, had lived in a camper and traveled around the country selling t-shirts.
Cool.
So we were even newer to the professional world. I was working for a small batch gin company out of Boulder doing their creative and marketing. And Paul was working for a small venture fund in Denver. And as you can imagine, a lot of cool offices around the city, they have stocked shelves and snacks and bevies. And so we were bringing home a ton of LaCroix and other more conventional sparkling waters. And Paul and I both, maybe part of the reason we were drawn to each other, grew up with very early adopter natural food moms. So very niche. I was going to friends' houses who had fruit roll-ups and like jamming them into my pockets, because at my house it was like cashews. You want a snack, like you can have what, like a leather belt, which were these like very horrible natural, like fruity fruit roll-ups.
Horrible branding. So anyways, too. It's like, that doesn't even sound good. Yeah.
That sounds really bad.
Yeah.
But we weren't allowed to drink soda at home. So Paul and I were just crushing sparkling waters early in our marriage, and felt like these are good. They're hydrating, but they're really not doing it for us. We're not obsessed with them like we obsess over other brands. There has to be a better way. Why does it go flat and have a bad aftertaste? And why aren't the flavors super artisanal or interesting? We want to be curious consumers, and it felt like the options were just sort of like citrus and nothing super compelling on the brand front either. So that was the beginnings. That was our first inkling, was 2019. We started using our soda stream at home and like crushing interesting herbs and frozen fruits into it and making our friends try weird concoctions. And eventually that evolved into what Ora Bora is today.
Wow. That's 2019 isn't even that long ago, really.
No, it is not that long ago. It's been a crazy couple of years. We officially launched, I would say, end of 2019, early 2020. We went to our first trade show at the end of 2019 with just a few hundred cans of Ora Bora. And then in early 2020, entered into our first grocery store. So it's been, you know, just over 2 years.
And like when you tell people, because that's a fast start. I mean, how do you come up with an idea like that, and then by the end of 2019, you have physical products? Like, that's pretty impressive. Like, how were you, especially with a category that's so competitive, how are you able to turn it around like that and like find like a manufacturer and figure out all of that?
Yeah. So I would say a big portion of it was luck, and I'll get into that. Mm-hmm. And then another portion of it was Paul, my husband and co-founder, is the type of entrepreneur I feel like you hear about most, which is just like immensely passionate, hardworking, and like if he has an idea, he's gonna get after it. And I say Paul is like that because I was just saying I'm a bit more introverted. I tend to be on the more creative side of things. And so my energy was a lot more like, let's take our time with the packaging. Let's spend 2 weeks coming up with how we're gonna name this and what the logo's gonna look like. So we kind of have a little yin yang there. But the luck part of it is that we're living in Denver, and we had no idea that Boulder Denver area, like one of the natural food capitals of the world. So, so many natural brands have come out of that area, and there are a ton of resources. So we were able to find a small co-packer there really early, which is a bit rare for new brands. A lot of times they're sort of making peanut butter in their kitchen for a couple of years. Or right. So we were able to do like our first very small production run at a co-packer in outside of Boulder. And on top of that, just general mentorship. I had worked for this small batch gin, and they used a designer and packaging designer from Boulder. So we had that connection. So we had a lot of things going for us that we didn't realize we had going for us until we got the ball rolling. And then I would say what got us from, we're sampling in the kitchen with our friends, we're talking to a packaging designer in Boulder, to like, we're on grocery store shelves, was that we raised a small amount of money from our family and friends to create our first 1,000 cans. And these were not on like a big production facility situation. These were just sort of like hand-filled cans that we brought to a trade show. And Paul and I had said, if this is popular at this Boulder trade show, we're gonna just do this thing. And Paul was gonna quit his job and just get after it. And we essentially sold out, and everyone was really excited about it. And we were like, okay, let's do this.
And how did you come up with the positioning for the brand?
So we saw a few things that just didn't feel right in sparkling water, despite how competitive and popular that category was at the time and still is. A big one was around brand, and that is definitely my wheelhouse and where I over-index when I shop too. And we wanted it to be like actually something you could delight over and share with people. And we felt that the conventional sparkling waters were more commodity energy than they were like beautiful and whimsical. And so we wanted that to be a big part of it. Actually, I have a can here. I know we're not on video, but I can show you.
It's beautiful. I mean, I obsess over the design. For anyone listening, please Google the brand, go to the website, and we'll plug it at the end. But like, unbelievable branding. I have like chills talking. I'm such a nerd for branding. Like, because it's such a big part of everything. Like, but when you see it on a shelf, it's just like, ooh, it looks so good. You guys did an amazing job.
Wow. Thank you so much. We're really proud of it. And it keeps evolving in a really fun way. So we wanted it to be colorful. We saw the craft beer movement in Denver was a lot more creative than the sparkling water space. So we were a little bit inspired by that. And then off the brand angle, but more towards sort of the ingredients and actual product, we knew this has to taste better. We don't want to include citric acid, which is, if you can think of that sort of tangy, bitter flavor sometimes you get in the aftertaste of sparkling water, or if you let it go flat. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that it doesn't usually taste very good. That's because it's easier to carbonate if you add citric acid. So we were like, let's not do that. It actually, for people who have IBS or other stomach and digestion issues, it can be problematic too. So that was a different positioning we were going for, which is just like generally better ingredients, artisanal herbal extracts, and truly funky flavors, which if you have not tried Ouroboros, it would be things like, our best seller is a cactus rose made with prickly pear.
It's so good. It's so good.
It's one of my favorites.
Yes.
Another one would be a lavender cucumber, which is really floral. And you've probably never seen a sparkling water with that flavor. And then actually today we dropped our limited edition lime cardamom, which a lot of people are like, what is cardamom? So we want that. We want it to be accessible enough that people may have tried it in like, say, a black tea or in a prickly pear margarita, but not so conventional that they probably have another option like it.
Love it. Makes perfect sense. I think for anyone listening who's, especially in the States, who's familiar with the sparkling water category, even if you're not in CPG, like consumer packaged goods, if you just like go to a store and look on the shelves, you'll probably see that a lot of the packaging just looks really dated. Like I think about LaCroix and I'm like, wow, it just looks dated and drab. And some of the colors are great, right? But like, the way I think too, when you think about packaging and how it really stands out on the shelf, like even for retailers, I would be like, this alone has like a shelf appeal, like really just pulls people in. So it's really cool that you guys put so much thought into the packaging. I want to go back to end of 2019. about to go into the pandemic when you're first starting your limited batch distribution, what was that point like scaling into the pandemic? Like, how did that end up working out for you guys?
Yeah. So, gosh, I think we all at the time had no idea how long this was going to last. So early in 2020, we weren't expecting it to drag on for years. So we were like, okay, grocery stores are kind of freaking out right now. They're not looking for discovery brands. They're looking for needs. And as much as we love sparkling water is low on the list of necessities in times of crisis. So that definitely impacted us in that in the first few months, we're just trying to get into distributors and into retailers. And funny enough, I have a vivid memory of Paul calling a retailer once who had just taken on our product, and it was mid to late March of 2020. And he called him, just wanted to say like, hey, did you get it? Is it on shelf? Like checking on the price point. And he got just chewed out by this, retailer who was like, have you been watching the news? Do you think he was basically like, do you think that I have time to check on your sparkling water? Paul got off the phone, was like, okay, like that's actually fair. But
and were you guys, so you were working a separate job during this time. So you were doing like double duty, right? And what about Paul?
Yes. Paul was full time. So from the start of Ora Bora, Paul knew this is going to be my thing. And I was still like definitely exploring the branding space. I was working at the time as a copywriter for a tech company. And we'd actually just moved to San Francisco. So we had a lot going on. But yes. In all my spare time, I was doing Ora Bora, social media, website building. And that actually goes to your question as well, is speaking of luck, we just sort of had a hunch that e-commerce could be a cool space to play in. And we thankfully had a Shopify site up and ready to rumble when the pandemic hit, and people started ordering online because they didn't want to go out. So we were really well positioned, thankfully. And that has continued to scale to this day and has become this cool channel where people can meet Ora Bora online, order their first case, and then probably find us in the natural grocer near them. So that was
a good awareness
hugely
play.
Beneficial. Yes, we watched as a number of brands in those next months following lockdown started launching e-commerce brands or ramping them. And so we were just glad that we had something ready to go.
Awesome. And of course, elephant in the room, we have to talk about Shark Tank. Of course, because I would imagine that that also plays into the path that you guys went down. So how did that conversation first start of thinking about even going to apply for it?
Yeah. So sorry, my dog's barking because okay. I think the mailman is here.
Of course.
But yes, very important.
Yeah.
So interestingly enough, summer of 2020, we got reached out to by a producer from Shark Tank. It came inbound into Paul's inbox through our website form, which no one ever used.
Yeah.
And we actually thought it was a prank. We were like, we have enough mean-spirited friends that this has to be one of them, because it was a message like, hey, Paul, love your brand. I'm one of the producers at Shark Tank and we want you to apply and we'd love to talk. And we were like, okay, so this is a lie. But we ended
nice
up
try.
Calling, yes. And it was real. And this producer had come across our brand, and it was really well-timed because their guest shark for season 12 was Daniel Libitsky, who was the founder of Kind Bar. And so they were looking specifically for fledgling food and beverage brands because Daniel could, you know, comment on them and have experience in the space. So that was the beginnings of conversation, and the application process and audition process and all of that sort of kicked off and went on through like early to the spring into summer of 2020. And then we ended up filming in the summer. It was crazy.
Was there any question in your mind that like, were you and Paul going back and forth thinking like, is this the right time? Like, should we do this? Or was it pretty clear that you guys were both on board?
We were shy about it. I think a big piece of it is obviously 5 million people watch it. And then there are reruns maybe forever. And it felt like there was some risk. One, the Shark Tank audience is not necessarily a natural grocery shopper audience. There are many of them, but also it's a lot of like middle of the country, more conventional shoppers. So that was one risk. The bigger one, I think we were genuinely afraid that it wouldn't be well received. So let's say, you know, all five judges, sharks, sip, and then are all like, this is gross, I don't like it. There really was a risk there. We had talked to some other brands that had gone on Shark Tank that had had that experience. And some of them had to do a full rebrand and renaming.
Oh my like, God. It had been, that's awful.
And that's not the most common thing
right,
to happen,
but still,
but it
it's
can definitely
huge.
Happen.
Yeah. There's no filter. I mean, there's really no filter.
Yes. We had reservations, but we also ended on, we would be so proud not to do this because it is the most enormous opportunity for exposure. And if we said no because we were worried we would look bad or we'd be embarrassed that our friends were watching, then we were proud. So we just were like, okay, we're going to prep really well and we're going to do it.
Yeah, amazing. And so leaning up to it, were you, I mean, I'd be sweating so much. Like when it was like the day of, like what was that like?
Okay, I'm going to set the scene here. We had to quarantine in a hotel room.
Oh,
we could not cross the threshold out into the hallway for 10 or 12 days. And so the amount of time we had to think about our fate was too much time. So I have some funny videos of Paul and I doing like acrobatics in our hotel room, just like trying to get energy out. But essentially 11 or 12 days in, someone knocks on your door and they're like, it's time, let's go. So yes, I mean,
that's terrifying.
I was just like, so I've never felt my heart in my chest the way I did as you prepare to walk down through that aisle when the double doors swing open.
Oh my
and you're
God,
walking.
Yes.
I was nervous that my voice wouldn't come out when we started our pitch, but, so yes, hugely. We were very nervous, but we also watched hundreds of hours of Shark Tank to prayer. We had an Excel spreadsheet of every question they've ever asked.
Wow.
We prepped like day and night. We Zoomed with our friends to practice. So we at least felt like...
Zoomed with your friends where they got to be the sharks? That's awesome.
Yes, no, we literally did role plays with our friends and family. So we were at least ready. We didn't think we were going to be surprised.
Yeah. Okay. Amazing. And for those listening, how did things pan out?
So it was great. We had that moment where they're cracking open the cans and getting ready to taste them. And I was so nervous, but I can't remember which shark it was. It might've been Mark. It might've been Robert goes, oh, wow, that's pretty good. And
you're like, oh my God,
tension
thank you.
In my body. And really well received. We ended up getting a deal with Robert Hershevik. Him and Mr. Wonderful both made offers and took the deal. It was huge. The biggest piece of it was when we aired in January of 2021. We had tens of thousands of people on our site. We had millions of eyes on our brand. And it still continues to pay off to this day. We grew our email list substantially. And we have fans in nearly every state. So huge, huge exposure. And it was definitely worth all the time and all the work.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you had a bunch of people, I'm sure, buying product, testing it out. Was there ever a worry that after Shark Tank, you would have to try and figure out how to keep the momentum going?
Yeah, I think we weren't 100% prepared to scale our sort of nurturing process with new customers. So having like emails ready to send when people abandon cart or when people need to know what grocery stores in their area sell Ouroboros. We didn't have all of that ready. We tried to have a lot of it ready, but there definitely was a fear that we would lose steam. Something that was actually a really nice silver lining to it was that retailers who are especially passionate about Shark Tank were really excited to not only carry Ora Bora, but like feature it at the front of their store, or, you know, give more shelf space to us, because they got to tell people who came in like, hey, that's the brand from Shark Tank. We've got it here. So that helped, because normally that stuff is costly, like merchandising and getting, you know, ton of shelf space can cost money and require a lot of relationship nurturing with retailers. But Shark Tank also helped with that, and I'm sure it helped keep some of those customers that had, you know, seen us on TV and might have forgotten about us the next week.
That's a huge benefit. If people are listening, entrepreneurs listening, who want to apply to Shark Tank, what would be like the biggest piece of advice you'd give them?
That is a great question. I think two things. One would be, don't compromise your brand, your tone, who you are, for a good show. I think there's a lot of incentive to want to blow people out of the water with how ridiculous or wild or memorable you are on TV, which all good things. But I think I'm grateful that Paul and I knew, like, yes, we want to put on a good show. Yes, we want people to love our brand, but this will live forever. So how do we also stay really true to who we are, who Ora Bora is, so that when it does live on, it's not, it doesn't feel inauthentic. But I would also say prep. We had a warehouse filled with boxes for orders. Even though we didn't know we were going to air yet, we were testing our site to make sure it could hold a ton of traffic. Just things you might not think about, we were starting to think about. And then if you're earlier in the process and you really just are hoping to get onto the show, it's tough. It's really competitive. We feel really lucky that we just were stumbled across. So I would also just say, don't get discouraged. If it's not actually a reflection of who you are or who your brand is, if you don't hear back, it's just sort of a time and place thing. And there are so many brands out there. And sometimes they're looking for things that you don't even know about.
That's such good advice. I think it's, that like gives me chills, because I think that's such kind advice to show that if you have something and for some reason you don't get on the show, it doesn't mean that you're, what you're working on is not worthy or valuable. It still 100%. Has a place. Yeah.
Yes. And if you think about the show, I think they do a combination of really interesting, innovative, well-branded brands, but they're also trying to make good TV. So they're exactly. putting on some crazy, ridiculous, how could this ever be a functional thing you'd pay for kinds of brands. Yeah. And so it really isn't personal. It really isn't. Yeah.
That's good advice. So after the show, you're talking to retailers, you're getting these placements, which is great. What were you and Paul, what were your goals at this point? Like, what were you thinking? Do you ever have a moment of like, okay, we made it, this is it? Or were you looking at your numbers, looking at e-commerce, looking at retail and being like, okay, here's where we want to go. Like, what was your roadmap like, I guess, you know, because I'm sure a lot of people after Shark Tank, they'd be like, okay, done, you know, like we did it, we made it, this is great. But it really depends on, you know, even like the lifestyle that you and Paul like envisioned for yourselves.
Totally. Yeah. I would say, I don't think we have had a moment to date where we have sort of like, you know, wiped our hands clean of the hard work and been like, we made it. We are there. I would say post Shark Tank, it was this amazing bump, a ton of customers, but we were just still going like, okay, we need to expand into more retailers. We at the time were probably in under 1,000 and definitely in under 1,000 doors. And now we're in closer to 3,000. So since airing, we've been pounding pavement, hiring a sales team, trying to get into more regions of larger chains. And that has been the goal all along. It's just like, how do we just inundate the market to a point where everyday people can say Ora Bora in the way that you can say LaCroix and people know what you're talking about. And that is literally just it feels like a never ending road, and I'm sure we'll get there one day. Yeah. But that's the goal. And speaking of lifestyle, the lifestyle also feels that endless right now, but we've gotten pretty used to it, which is like, we're not done. The work is not done. Which I would say I'm pretty counter like productivity hustle culture. So I don't like to, romanticize that at all, but that's definitely what it has felt like, which is just, hey, this is great, really exciting. Oh, we got into another region of Whole Foods. That's exciting. Oh, you know, we're recently national at Sprouts. That's exciting.
Huge.
And now we got to sell on those shelves. Right. There's always another thing.
Yeah. Let's talk about hiring your first teammates and how you guys figured that out. Because I think that's a question that a lot of entrepreneurs have of when do you know? Like, say, like for you as a physical product, right? Distribution, huge part of, like, just as important as marketing, really. So how do you assess first few people that you decide to hire? What was your thought process for that?
Yeah. So how do you know it's time to hire? I will say we were absolutely too late. Paul got to a point, and I guess this was earlier last year, Paul got to a place where he was like, if I get one, I'm hardly sleeping, I'm incredibly overwhelmed. And two, if I got hit by a bus, Bora Bora would die. I know too much. I am all of the information is in my brain about our operations, how we package, how, where the cans are coming from, when they're arriving, like all of these details are solely in my brain. And it became so overwhelming that the first hire we made was actually, it began as an executive assistant for Paul. And she was our first hire. She's still with us today. And she's actually evolved into our like customer service czar. If anyone's out there who has messaged Ouroboros customer service, I'm sure you know Kirsty because she is the like brand voice on the customer care side.
Cool.
So that was our first hire. Hugely helpful because up until that point, Paul was fielding and myself every email that came in about, hey, I opened my can and I cut my lip. Or like, hey, I didn't know that Ouroboros was sparkling.
Oh my God, really? People are sending these messages?
Definitely. So, and
are these just people that are bored at home? Like, who is sending these? Like, this is ridiculous.
I actually think that theory is exactly spot on. So anyways, that was our first hire. And then from that point, we went looking for folks to do sales because Paul was cold calling retailers, showing up at their door, driving around in his Subaru all over the Bay Area, trying to sell into natural grocers. And it was just time to have folks on our team who'd done this before, which I haven't, you know, mentioned this yet, but we'd never done this before. So everything we were doing was just like, maybe this will work. So now we have a team of 12, and that spans sales, social media, and graphic design.
Wow. Full time?
Yep.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, so it has been huge. And our quality of life has gone up substantially just knowing that there are other people in this who really care about Ouroboros. And obviously, the stakes aren't as high, but they're pretty high. So that's how we landed on it's time to build a team. And that actually coincided with a seed round of funding, which obviously, if you want to build a team, you got to have money. So we raised $2 million in 2021 to help us grow our team.
That's awesome. That's amazing. I want to talk about the fact that you and Paul started this together. We talked at the beginning of this call before we started recording about just being a female founder in this space that, especially in this time, when you look at after COVID, even you'd think of the support and funding that women get, and it's even lower than it was before. What has it been like being a team of two and being the female counterpart to that? And how do you think that that's affected your journey as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I was reflecting after Expo West, which is one of the largest trade shows in the world. It took place in Anaheim this year. It's for food and beverages. And it's a few days of basically every food and beverage you've probably ever heard of that's new-ish on the block, sets up a booth, is doing samples for retailers and investors and consumers. And I think in part this shows how, like, what wonderful communities and workspaces I've been in the past. But I came back from that trade show, which was 80% wonderful and 20% very discouraged about women in this space because it felt, I never felt marginalized in my work before until I regularly was dismissed or overlooked by people who really wanted to talk to the founder. I was honestly had more than 10 occasions, very uncomfortable interactions with older male retailers or investors saying things like, hey, you should smile more. What? Things that I was like, what is happening? So I felt more passionate than ever that this space needs to shed light on the women who are creating things and who are founders, especially. I feel very lucky that Paul is my counterpart, and we definitely fall into the more traditional gender roles of he is doing the finance things, he's doing the ops things, I'm doing the creative designy things, and that's working for us. But yeah, there are some amazing female founders out there who are doing all of that and who are fundraising, and it's just an uphill battle, and there are a lot of very stayed, long-lasting retailers and folks who've been in this industry for a long time who are more likely to listen to men.
Yeah.
And we felt that way with our sales team too. It can be quite a bit more difficult for women in sales as well. So all that to say, we're in the midst of a Series A right now, and I will say there are some amazing venture capital groups that are women focused or exclusively invest in women founded brands. And I can tell that that's going to keep happening and happen more and more. So there is definitely a light at the end of that tunnel, but it was felt for sure.
What advice would you give to, I mean, it's not really to women, but what do you think it's going to take to change all of this? Because it's really not about advice for women. It's a cultural shift that needs to happen. But what is it, if you could say, you know, if these things changed, we'd be in a better place?
I think a lot of this will unfortunately come down to turnover, being that there are a lot of older men investors and retailers that are have been operating in this space for such a long time that they're actually not accustomed to young female founders. And I will say, like, in part, I can be understanding and empathetic to that. And also, I think that we're due for a change, and it's actually happening right now. I just think it takes some time. And that's sort of a hard reality, is that some things do just take some time. But I will also say, I was so encouraged by how cool and driven and intense some of these founders I met at Expo West were, who are either like solo female founders or like doing it with co-founders. But I would say it's moving in the right direction. I don't know what it's going to take to expedite that process other than really cool and brave and impressive people powering through and proving people wrong.
Yeah, I love that. I also like that you mentioned the VC opportunities, because if you can identify with those and you can find other people at conferences and similar events, it creates that camaraderie that really helps and makes you feel like you're not alone, even if you are a solo female founder or you have two females as founders. So yeah, I think that's good advice. What do you think entrepreneurs need to hear right now?
I was saying earlier how I get a little cringy with productivity culture and how, and I think it works for some people, but for me at least, I often feel like, well, that's not me. So I would say, more than anything, if you're creating something, if you're an entrepreneur and either you're thinking about creating something or you're in the midst of it and it feels really hard, which I would say that's probably anyone who's created anything feels that, it's okay if it doesn't work. I think that's probably the biggest thing I would say, is your endeavor, whatever you're working on, which you probably poured your heart and soul into, if it doesn't work, it doesn't mean it wasn't good. It doesn't mean it wasn't a good thing. It doesn't mean that you did a bad job. Just as much as it is rewarding for your baby to turn into something incredibly profitable and impactful, there is like every step of that journey, which is learning new things along the way. I try to reflect on that all the time. Like, oh, I didn't used to know how to create packaging. I didn't used to know how to build a website page. And I didn't used to know how to get really organic engagement on social media. And now I do. and that will never go away. So even if Ora Bora one day is everyone stops drinking sparkling water, that won't go away. So I think, honestly, more entrepreneurs need to hear, like, it's okay if this doesn't work or if this isn't the thing. Then they need to hear, like, keep going, like, rise and grind.
Yes, rise and grind.
That is what I would say.
And how do you know? I mean, this is a really hard question, but how do you know if something isn't working?
Gosh, I would say it definitely depends on what you're doing. Probably a huge indicator is if you're not in a position or if you're not desiring to raise money and you're not profitable.
Hmm.
So you probably would get to a point where it's completely unsustainable and incredibly stressful, especially if it's the only thing you're working on. You don't have Yes. other income streams. That would be a big one. I'd say probably on a more personal note, if you are so incredibly burnt out that you don't feel the passion for what you're doing anymore, I think that there's a time to push through and that burnout doesn't necessarily reflect like your true feelings about what you're doing. But I also think there's a time to trust your gut and your own personal wellness and know like, hey, I can keep doing this. I might be able to become profitable or I might be able to get to a place where I'm raising money, et cetera, or you're acquired. But I do think there's also a weighing the pros and cons of your lifestyle, the impact on your health, the time you can spend with family and friends and how much you've given up to chase after something. I think there's probably a time when you need to reckon with those things and reflect on what you care about most. So probably twofold, either, hey, it's not making money, and it's not sustainable and you can't find a way to make it sustainable, or in your gut, you know, I've sacrificed too much and I no longer care enough about this and I want to focus on other things.
Such a good, thoughtful answer. I love that. I think that's really, really true. And I love that you touch on the personal piece too, because the rise and grind, I mean, I laugh because I just like picture that like on a mug on someone's desk or something.
Yes.
Like,
I don't know.
I mean, it's just so prevalent, you know, and even after COVID, it's especially prevalent. And the more we talk about it, the less scary it becomes. And the more we can like combat it and say like, it doesn't always have to be that way. So I appreciate that thought. Where is Ora Bora headed? Like, what's next for the brand?
Yeah. So as I was saying, we're continuing to grow into more retailers. So we're like edging on 3,000 doors, which is really exciting. Huge. And means that every day someone new meets the brand for the first time, which a small anecdote is that we were in our local co-op down the street recently. It's called Other Avenues. It's in San Francisco. We love it. And every time we're in there, Paul will watch someone look at the drink fridge, trying to decide what sort of like roadie they're going to pick up. And he'll, every time without fail, he did this just last week, be like, have you tried that sparkling water company? It's really, it's really interesting. Like, my favorite is this, you know, cactus and I think it might just be social pressure, but every time the person will be like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess I'll give it a try.
They like reluctantly bring it to the cash register.
Yes, exactly. They're like,
I wasn't even thinking about this.
Exactly. They're like, I was looking for hummus, but okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyways.
But probably really fun people watching. That's probably good, right? Like,
it is really fun. And then, so beyond expansion into more retailers, we're also like nurturing a bomb community. And I say that with a lot of pride today because we just launched this limited edition flavor. It's something we do a lot on our website. And we partner with environmental nonprofits and we give a portion of our sales towards, right now, our latest drop has a praying mantis on the can.
So
her name is Lima. And we're donating to the Xerces Society, which works with like protecting habitats, ecosystems, watersheds, and invertebrates. So amazing. That's been not a huge revenue builder for us, although it's great, but more so leaning into who we want to be as a brand, which is we actually do care about sustainability. We actually do care about innovating new flavors because our community is really epicurious. Mm-hmm. And we get to use that as an experimentation zone. So that's definitely a big part of where we're headed, is continuing to nurture this cool, curious, weird community of people who we adore. And then I would say lastly is growing our team. So we're raising Series A right now, like I said, so that's going to help us grow more than ever. And so we'll definitely hire more sales folks. We'll definitely have more boots on the ground. We have a new ambassador program where people are sampling. So this post-COVID world that we're moving towards is about to look a lot different for our brand too. So that's where we're headed.
It's amazing. You guys have so much going on. It's insane. But like, good for you though. It's like, it's awesome. Like, huge momentum. And I love that you talk about too, how you kind of like carried that from probably a big spike like Shark Tank, and how you're able to like stabilize and maintain it, because it just goes to show you that it's not like it's one big thing that happens and then everything changes. It's kind of like, it's like a little blip, and then you just keep going and you're stable, but you're still growing in ways that need team and people behind it. So it's good. The work is never done. Not a hustle culture, but just saying that, you know, it's like, the work is really 100%. Never done.
Yes.
Lastly, where can people find you?
So we're in multiple regions of Whole Foods. We are just launching nationally in Sprouts. So you can definitely find us there, including one of our limited edition flavors that will be an exclusive at Sprouts. It's elderflower grapefruit, and it is my absolute favorite. We're in Fresh Time.
It's amazing.
No,
it sounds so good.
So good. We are in Fresh Time and Erewhon. And if you can't find us and you don't know how to find us, we have a map on our website. You can just plug in your zip code at Ourabora.com and it'll show you what's nearby. And the very worst case, if you're in the boonies, is you can order a case right to your house from our site. So you've got options.
So not the boonies, but I'm very excited. I'll probably like announce this at some point, but we just reached 100 countries of listeners, which is amazing for the podcast, which is great.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations.
Thanks. We're so happy. But for people that are listening that are not here, which we do have a lot of people elsewhere, can they purchase the product, or is it just
US?
Okay.
It's just in the US right now. So come visit.
Yeah.
We would love to have
over
you
here.
We have great sparkling water here.
Yeah.
And
love it.
Yeah,
but it's so cool. When someone makes a trip here, they can go to one of the retailers and grab one. It's like a fun 100%. Little
and actually
thing.
Grocery stores are fun. Not all
yeah,
of
they
them,
are fun.
But a lot of them are. So
yeah.
Hey, what was your 100th country?
Oh, one that I really wanted for a while, which sounds so like stupid, because it's not like I'm like, better get this country, you know, but I was like, it's Greenland. So thank you, Greenland. I was like very happy.
Shout
about
out.
Yeah. Shout out to Greenland.
Okay.
It's
I
just
hope
like
whoever
really
in Greenland is listening.
Yeah. I just, yeah, exactly. If you're listening, come visit us. Thank you. So yeah, really exciting. But this was amazing. Thank you so much for coming in the podcast. And can't wait to go to the store and pick some up. So thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Real talk, I think Manny is probably one of my favorite people I've had on the podcast. I know I say that often. And if you're listening and you've listened to a lot of the episodes, you probably know I say that all the time. But I loved Manny's enthusiasm. And not only that, but also just how candid she was about her experience from going on Shark Tank to also just being a female founder in this space. I love that she didn't sugarcoat anything and was just really candid and honest. So I hope you guys appreciated that too. It's so fun to talk to founders on this podcast and really hear their story from their perspective. And I'm just grateful to have this podcast, grateful to have you as a listener, and I hope you really enjoyed this episode. If you did, as always, make sure to go give us a rating and review. It really helps the podcast grow and get in front of more people. And I appreciate you guys as listeners. Thanks for sticking around, and I will catch you in next week's episode. Have a good one.